that we've been discussing. So Robert, why don't you just pass that baby around real quick here, and then just so people can put hands on it, and then we'll delve into it.
This is what you had in your office in town, right?
Yes, it is.
About 10 pounds per foot.
So
it's got 10 pounds of duct tape cover on the outside.
That's specialized.
Copper.
That's what
the sheet. The stuff next to the copper is the paper wraps. That's all the paper wraps, yeah. And then, and
that's what's impregnated with
oil.
This mineral.
The oil's in here, and it gets through the copper as well. And then this whole thing is oil filled, basically. That lead sheath is what keeps it in.
So let me just make one clear statement here before we go any further. So these are fluid filled, but you know, we don't have any evidence yet, solid evidence that there's been any significant leakage. We did have an alarm that was showing some lowering of pressure in the particular line, and then we essentially blinded it off on both ends. To my analogy earlier, put our finger over the top of the straw on both ends of the cable, and that's where we're at today. So we don't want to speculate that there's been anything there that's happened so yet until we have the facts. So
okay, so somewhere in this whole field of things, something's broken, you're getting oil out and maybe seawater in.
Yeah, I think the more important thing maybe to focus on in this discussion is just to talk about the fault portion of it, rather than the fluid.
What do you mean about fault? Did that copper core break?
This is where I'm going to punt to our electrical engineer to give you a full explanation.
So at this time, we'll go ahead and have Robert.
And we've done some test work to the cable. Okay. It shows
now. You brought that or pass this around?
No, pass that thing around. I've got my prop right here.
I don't think I can pick it up.
You lift it?
Just be careful. Yeah. Scratch the table there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Nick.
You know, I keep this in my office for every waste.
Don't drop it.
What are you doing this here?
So it's important to understand that in using the terminology in regard to this, and to maintain the fact that we want to keep our liability as small as possible, that we're going to talk about the fault and failure.
Right.
And that's how we'll discuss it.
And if I could just say one thing. So just my understanding is we don't have any clear evidence either way about what the cause of this was for purposes of insurance reporting purposes, right, or if there's any spills for purposes of having to disclose it to any entities out there, what permits are required at this point. So my best advice to you all is best not to speculate about that until we have hard and fast information about what our obligations are.
Thank you.
Robert. So I think we'll start with the cable you're looking at there. The copper in the middle, that's the water to wire. So we take the energy out of the dams and we transmit it on the wire. And it's at 69,000 volts, so that's your pressure, like in a hose. The higher the pressure, which we have to do, the lower the flow. So we have a high pressure on there, and to keep that pressure inside that, that's where you have all the insulation. And that's what the insulation is doing. It's like the outer part of your rubber hose. The bigger, the higher the pressure, the larger the hose is, if you will. That insulation prevents those electrons, that pressure, from exiting that cable. All the rest of that that's in that that you're holding in your hand there is to protect that insulation. So the lead sheath keeps the oil in, protects the paper. Then you've got more insulation outside of that, and then you've got your actual your reinforced steel on the outside of it. So that most of that cable is for reinforcement. The size of it.
And the purpose of the hole in the middle?
That's where the oil is.
The oil is in the hole in the middle.
Yep.
Okay.
So a fluid-filled, the fluid-filled cable is A, for insulation, and two, salt water is about 20% more dense than fluid. The fluid. So at high depths, that salt water will try and intrude into the insulation, and at the time of manufacturing of this, they didn't have XLPL insulation that could sustain those depths. So oil filled was a typical way to do it under pressure. It helps to push against the pressures of the depths of the ocean, given that salt water is 20% more dense. So that's kind of the theory on the design on that in the day. Nowadays they make dry type cables that are not fluid filled, and that's because we've come a long way with our with insulation and our chemical processes.
That also helps with the thermal expansion of the cable if we have any changes.
Absolutely. It does help with cooling as well. Fortunately, our cables are not used to their capacity, so there is no real heating in our cables, which is one of the reasons why we should have a very long life of the cables. You do not have any deterioration of the insulation, which would be the oil. And the only way that the fluid-filled insulation on these cables would deteriorate would be a function of heat. And we don't have that because we don't utilize the full capacity of the cables, maybe 25-30%. But I kind of wanted to go from the beginning, what happened, when it happened, what we saw, what we did, and then where we are today. And that's kind of what this report was. It's an after-action report. So I'll walk through it, and most of you have probably read it, but I'll go through some of the explanations on it a little more in depth. So first of all, September 29th, we had a fault. Petersburg lost power from a submarine appeared to be at the Stikeen crossing. If you look at that first graph there on page one, it shows that there are waveforms on the top. Those waveforms are the currents, the actual the flow, if you will, of electrons. And you can see the C phase went up significantly. It went from about 50 amps peak to peak to 500 amps. So that's about 10 times the amount, which means it's like it acted as if a welder, or if you just had a an unlimited load that was trying to draw from Tai. So what the relay does is it sees that increase in current or in flow, and it reacts as fast as it can. And so this looks like there's a lot of cycles there, up and downs, but this happened in 200 milliseconds. So within 1/5 of a second, we were able to clear the fault. And when we say fault, that means that copper is not, the electrons are not traveling down the copper anymore, they're going to ground somewhere, and they're returning back to the plant instead of going to a load. So we cleared the fault in about 200 milliseconds, which is typical for this application. And the first step was to find out, well, where is it? Was it on land? Was it at the substation? Was it a transformer? So the Schweitzer relay at Tai has a distance element to it. It calculates the impedance of the line. And if that impedance changed because you had something change in the middle of it, it calculates that impedance change. And it says, oh, it's this far out. And it recorded 52.3 miles from Tai, which puts it somewhere around the Vank Island Marine Crossing. So initially we thought it was at Vank Island, or at the Marine Crossing, or possibly a pothead, something that was, and when I say pothead, a pothead is where the cable comes out of the water and it connects to the overhead line. You have to have a big insulator there because the cable's oil filled. So first of all, you gotta inject oil into there, into the cable, and then you have to big insulator so that it doesn't, because it's everything, the structure's all ground. So you have to make sure that you don't have the wire to ground. So it's just a big insulator stack.
So the news is going to say electrical pothead causes fault.
and they're legal now, too. Can't go after them.
Electrical terms are very funny in that way. But, you know, mechanical terms are that way, too. I can name
Are we insured against potheads?
That was actually the first
gap.
That was the first thing we wanted to find out. We wanted to know whether it was a pothead, a surge arrestor, just an insulator, or whether if it was near shore. Because as soon as you start moving offshore, the logistics of the repair changed dramatically. So we had to find out whether it was inshore. So pressure, as Trey mentioned, on the Warnowski and the Vank Island, pressure began to drop, and we got a pressure alarm. So the first indication was there may be an issue with the cables, and we flew out there immediately and hydraulically locked them, as he mentioned. Basically, what that's happened, what that's doing is, the straw theory is correct. These, on each side of Vank and each one of our marine crossings, there are tanks. And in those tanks, there are bellows. And those bellows, basically, it's a volume of air over oil that gives you the ability to have a chamber that can provide energy to push oil in or out. So if you have a fault on the cable and salt water is 20% more dense than it, you're going to want that's going to want to start to push the oil into those bellows. As soon as the pressure is more on the cable than what this pressure is in those tanks, it's going to start pushing the air out of that tank or compressing that air, and that means salt water is going to ingress. But if you lock it down on both sides, it doesn't have anywhere to go. You can only go as much as oil will compress, which is, in this case, virtually none. So it can't go into the tanks. You've effectively locked it down, and the only part that you're going to have ingress or salt water into the cable is short or close to the location of whether it be a leak or the faulted area. Salt water in that, once you get salt water into that paper, it's ruined. There's no fixing that. You cut it out, you throw it away, you replace it with another piece. Hopefully during lunch today we'll all get to see a video on how to do a repair. And if we have time on the actual 1984 video of the way they laid the cables in the water, which is kind of good informative information. So going on, the first step was now that we knew that there was, you know, we had pressure loss and we had locked down the cables, we had to identify how far, whether it was onshore, offshore, and how far it was. Because like I said, that really affects mobilization of what type of boat to do the repair, and it affects what methodology you use for that repair, which significantly changes cost. So we ordered a time domain reflectometer, and it's basically like a radar. It sends a pulse on a line, and if there is any change in the insulation on it, that pulse will be reflected back to you. It's just like if you had a big pipe and a smaller pipe, and you let water hit, you send water into that pipe. When it hit the smaller pipe, you'll get a water hammer back. The timing of that is what tells you how far that smaller pipe is. So if you have a fault on a cable, for example, whether it's open or closed, you have a change in the size of that pipe. It happens with a splice, and it happens with a fault. It happens with any kind of change in the actual insulation qualities. So using the TDR, the first thing was to find out on a good known cable of how fast does that pulse, that initial signal that we're sending down the cable, how fast does it travel down the cable? So electrons, for example, they travel just about nearly the speed of light. In a cable such as that, or in a coaxial cable to your house, or in other cables, they travel at a fraction of a speed of light, and it depends on the type of cable, because there is what's called attenuation and a propagation of velocity, or a velocity factor. So we had to determine what the velocity factor was, how fast does the pulse travel down the cable. With the known length of the cable that we were testing, we were able to find out what that speed was, and then apply that to the cable that was actually faulted C-phase, and then we would see a reflection and know exactly how far out the fault was. That was the very first thing to do, because before we moved in experts and brought in, expensive, which is the next step, expensive test equipment, we had to make sure that it wasn't just on the shore. So on the second page, that once we found the distance of the good cable, and we located the end of it, you see a positive reflection. That just shows that if it's a positive reflection, that means that the impedance on the cable, it's like the cable got bigger. And that's because you have an open circuit at the end. So the bigger it gets, it looks positive. The smaller it gets, which would be like a fault, then it dips and looks negative. So we were able to identify the speed of propagation, the how fast does an electron travel down a known good cable from the same manufacturer, and we applied that to the faulted cable. What we found was from the Vank Island side, we've seen a reflection, a negative reflection. This will be on your page 3. We've seen a negative reflection at about 14,884 feet. Now the cable is the length of that cable is 16,982 feet, so it looked to be at around 2,000 feet. In this case, 2,097 feet from the other side. Now the accuracy of this device that we're using, the TDR, it's 1%, but it's 1% of the range. So if I were to look out there 1,000 miles, I would have to have the range really large. Then the accuracy would only be 1% of that. So you want to get closer to the fault to increase the accuracy. Not only that, you want to verify that what you read from one end, you're seeing the same from the other end. So then we flew over to the other side and we performed the same measurement and got the accuracy down to approximately 80 feet on either side of the fault and found it to be at approximately 2,000 feet. Page 4 shows it where 1,997 feet is what the test device read, but given the accuracy of it, it could be anywhere between 1,915 feet and 2,079 feet from the shore. So now that we knew that it was offshore, the question was where offshore, because we have the original Furukawa documents that show where they laid it, but from our understanding is in 1984, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's where they really are. There wasn't as great of technology in 84 on drones or underwater drones and location devices. So you typically got the values of where the ship was when it was laying the cable. But any kind of tide or any kind of movement of the cable may have shifted it underneath. So what we have for documentation may or may not have been accurate. So the next step was to get somebody to get down there and locate and say, okay, where are the cables and how do they really lay? And so we got a bathymetric survey or a multi-beam survey done of the Stikine crossing with a lot of focus and detail on that side where we knew that the fault was. And you can see that on some of your in the appendix. But on page 6, you could really see the multi-beam survey, and you can see how the land lays in terms of rock formations and bluffs and anything of that nature. Looking at from the bottom of the image to the top, you can see the phases laid in there, and what you have there is you have A phase on the very bottom, and then you have your spare cable, and then you have B phase, and then you have C phase. So A, the spare, and B phase are laid side by side with each other. And our only understanding, which we don't have all the documents for exactly how they laid it, but our only understanding at this point is they did not want to go over the rock bluff on C phase, and so they went around it. And that's why you see it kind of cut through a valley and be laid the way it is. Right now, this information that we have done by E-Track, they used what's called a magnometer, and that is basically like a metal detector. And they drop it down 600 feet or as close to the shore as they can, and they detect any kind of ferrous items or magnetic items in the water. So they'll get a lot of erroneous items. But as soon as you start getting kind of a trail, then you know that's a cable. It's not an anchor, it's not a ship, it's not a chain. So they were able to map out the cables fairly accurately, and in the report we could see where the cables lie. With the 2,000 foot now TDR information, we could utilize the charts that they gave us and map it along the path of the cable and give you that circle that said, hey, this is where the fault location is. Now with bathymetric, you know what depth as well. So it's at about 300 to 400 feet is where it's sitting, which is right there on the edge of whether or not divers are usable. And it's right at the edge of moving from 300 to 600. It's a kind of a steep drop off. Like Trey mentioned, we can't speculate the cause of the fault at this point because we don't have enough information. And so when he said that we need more money for the future costs, the main thing is to find out what was the cause. And we need to further identify how deep is the cable, or what ability of repair do we have? What kind of repair process, or if any, do we have? And then confirm the route and do further testing, because 80 feet on either side is kind of a wide range, especially if you're going to go down with a diver and try and do some pinpoint location. So now the next step would be to bring in experts that do this for a living with specialized tools, and now that they've got it within a smaller location, they can really hone in on that. So some of the things that they might use is like a toner, similar to like you do in telephone systems. You'd stick a certain frequency on it, and that frequency can be heard by either a microphone or something, some kind of sensing device, and you could have sonar or a receiver drop that down close to the fault or the location of where we think the fault is, and further identify that area. And then with other technology similar to what we already had with a magnometer, you get right on top of where the cable is, and you can ping to see how far you are, where you are at the bottom, and how far it is from the actual bottom, so see how deep it is. Because if it's 5 feet, 5 to 10 feet, we could probably rip it up. If it's 30 feet, maybe we won't be able to get it out of the mud. That's going to be a huge huge factor in determining whether or not whether we can fix it. Another thing, you know, in 2018, we had ITB do the submarine ROV inspection of all the cables, of all the crossings. And on page 7, there were two cables that had pretty significant spans, cables 2 and 3, furthest to King Crossing. And those spans have approximately 30 feet of gap between where they are laying in the bottom and the earth. So typical measures to fix a span of that type would be to take rock pebbles and kind of slide them underneath the cable and kind of build up a bottom for them. But with 30 feet and 1,400 feet, you're getting out of that possibility. So there, you know, when we talk about in terms of all of SEPA's cables, those would be the elevated risk cables. Now there wasn't ITB didn't put a risk assessment on those cables in terms of whether or not they're going to fail today or tomorrow, because that's something that's not easily performed. But what we did see from the videos is that there is no damaged on the cables that have the large spans. There is no damaged armor cable on them. And if you look at, if you go online and you just look at any kind of damaged cable, you'll start seeing that armor cable fail. And our testing so far, the last 10 years I've looked at, hasn't shown any sign of deterioration of the cable. So elevated risk, but I can't, and I don't know if anyone could at this point put a height of risk, whether it's medium, high, or whatever. So that is pretty much where we are today. The future, like Trey mentioned, we did interview. We had had a cable consultant in the past. His name was Jim Patchett, and he has been he has written a few different reports for us. Now we didn't have him under contract at this time, but he was our first guy to call. And this cable world, undersea cables, is a real small world, and they're all very friendly, not only with customers but with each other So they're all willing to help right away. I think it's exciting to them. Just the whole being a small group of people that are the experts in the field. So Jim, per his instructions, that's why we did. The first thing we did was hydraulically lock the cable down, do the TDR testing, do the E-track contract to go and further identify what the bottom lay looks like. So our next step now is to actually bring in a full-time consultant, get them on contract, and determine, because our next step, I think our next decision is going to change the cost of it significantly and possibly affect the risk of success. So, any questions?
Robert.
Yeah, a couple questions. What kind of time frame are you looking at? Obviously, this has me a little bit nervous. What kind of time frame are you looking at to come to a point of where you make a decision down the road? What you thinking?
Well, first, can I just start with first, the intent of the spare cable is for today. That's why you install a spare cable. So we went 35 years on four cables, and we're utilizing the spare. That's for what it's intended. It's intended purpose. So there is no, right now, there is no, in our opinion, there is no, like, risk that tonight your cable is going to fail. I mean, there's always risk, but there's no elevated risk on we need to do something right away. That being said, you do not have a spare anymore. So we are doing something right away. I just don't want the elevated, the sky falling scenario to happen. We have a spare for a reason. We've heard estimates as fast as 6 to 9 months on a repair or on a full replace. So on a repair, we don't know that answer yet, because we don't know if there's even specialized splicers. That was one of the biggest questions that we had and our questions for our interviews for our consultants. Are there any splicers in the world that can do this anymore? Because this cable was discontinued 10 years ago. Nobody makes this lead sheath. Lead sheath is not environmentally friendly anymore. And so this type of cable is not manufactured, and the guys that were experts, and this is, when you watch the video, you'll see how you need an expert to do this, because it is a very fine process on how you wrap each piece of paper. There's hundreds of pieces of paper in there that are wrapped and soaked in oil. You wrap each one of them, and when you do the lead sheet, that's got to be sealed, because that's got to hold pressure. These were under 80 PSI, is what these cables were under. The deeper the cable goes, the higher the pressure you got to have on it, because you got that much pressure at the bottom of the ocean. So I don't have a full answer for you, but I gave you a few of those numbers.
So I can add to that maybe just a little bit. So essentially looking at next steps, you know, we'll get the consultant on board and confirm this morning that he's our guy and as other folks that are familiar with this person know, he's probably the best guy out there for right now for our needs. And then we'll take a harder dive into the data sets we've already taken, let them fully review all of our testing, and then we'll put together an additional test plan if that is the direction that seems most prudent. There's just a couple of unknowns that bother me right now, and one of them is I don't know how deep the cable is buried. If it was laying right on top, you know, my recommendation, let's go after a repair. That's why we got these repair kits. That's why we got the extra cable, all that. But it could be 20, 30 feet deep, and we may not be able to recover it. So that's a big unknown for me. And anytime you do a repair, there's risk you can damage the cable when you're bringing it up. There's risk when you start cutting it back, trying to get past the water intrusion. That may exceed the extra piece of cable you have, right? So there'll be some, where I'd like to end up at the day is to make some, provide the board with some options based on some data that we've taken, assess the risk of each one of those options, and also include some type of an off-ramp for those type of options. you know, an example of what I mean there is if we start down the path that maybe we'd like to go affect an interim repair so we can do a replacement on more of a non-expedited pathway, maybe, you know, we get there and we start pulling it up and we find we can't get the cable up, you know, there should be an off ramp there, here's the stop work now, stop the bleeding of money, let's go to plan B and go for the full replacement or something. So there's a lot of options there, and I mentioned it briefly earlier that, you know, there's an option just to replace the failed cable with a three conductor cable. That's a possibility. But you still got to order the cable, you got to wait for it, you still got to mobilize the boat, you still got to pull the old one out. There's a whole bunch of stuff that would still have to happen. And then you got to compare that with the overall cost to do well. Do we just want to replace the whole crossing? Because we know we have some, I'll say, more elevated risk with the two suspended cables. And then geologically, just taking a step even further back, well, knowing what we do and what we can see, those cables that are suspended.